73. A Circle of Wrongs. The door from the bedroom to the dining room was ajar, and he heard the wall clock's single loud stroke and the lingering echoes that followed. Half past something. Adam Reutemann would have looked at his wristwatch, which was ticking away sociably on the bedside table, but he was afraid that switching the light on suddenly would awaken his wife, who slept sometimes on her side and sometimes prone, with her face pressed against her husband's shoulder. They had been married nearly 5 years, but feeling her close to him, sleeping in her funny way, warming her chilly little feet between his legs, made him feel tenderly protective, even when he was only half awake. Adam had woken from an uneasy sleep. He would have liked to go to sleep again, but last night's news and the unpleasantness at work came back to him. Anxious thoughts chased one another. His eyes refused to close, and he was in that middle-of-the-night wide-awake state in which it is useless trying to sleep. The buzz of voices, the shuffling of feet, and the noise of furniture moved around in the Makarygin's apartment overhead had gone on late into the night, but had long since ceased. A faint greyish light seeped in through the gap where the curtains did not quite meet. In his night attire, flat on his back and sleepless, Adam Veniaminovich Reutemann no longer felt that his position was secure and himself a cut above other people, as he did in the daytime, thanks to his epaulettes, Major, Ministry of State Security, and his medal, Stalin Prize winner. He lay there supine and felt, like any ordinary mortal, that the world was overpopulated and unkind, and that living in it was not easy. Last night, when the merrymaking at the Makarygins was in full swing, an old friend of Reutemann's, also Jewish, had called on him. He had arrived without his wife, very worried, full of stories about fresh harassments, discriminatory regulations, dismissals, and even banishment. None of this was news. It had begun last spring with the apparently innocent mention in brackets of the Jewish names that certain theatre critics had dropped. Then it had crept into literature. In one scandal sheet, a pink newspaper that dabbled in everything except what was supposed to be its concern, literature, someone had whispered the poisonous word cosmopolitan. The word they had all been waiting for. A beautiful word, a proud word. A word that made the whole world one. At one time it had been bestowed on the noblest of geniuses, Dante, Goethe, Byron. But in this gutter newspaper it became a pallid, wizened, hissing thing and now meant only Jew. After which it crept away, shamefacedly hiding in files behind closed doors. Now the cold draft had reached the scientists. In the past month, Reutemann, who had been steadily, brilliantly advancing toward glory, had suddenly felt the ground giving way under his feet. Did his memory deceive him? During the Revolution, and for a long time afterward, Jew had meant more reliable than Russians. Russians were checked further back. Who were your parents? What was their source of income before 1917? Jews were all in favor of the Revolution. Then, suddenly, lurking behind the backs of a bunch of nobodies, who should take on the role of scourge of the Israelites but Joseph Stalin? If a group of people are persecuted because they were once oppressors, or members of a privileged caste, or because of their political views or their circle of acquaintance, there is always a rational, or pseudo-rational, explanation for it. You are always aware that you yourself have chosen your lot, that you need not have stayed in that particular group. But nationality? Here Reutemann's nocturnal interlocutor lodged an objection. People surely did not choose their social origins either, but were punished for them. But what hurt Reutemann most was that you may want with all your heart to belong, to be like everybody else, yet you are snubbed, rejected, told that you are an outsider, a lost soul, a Jew. The wall clock in the dining room began striking with unhurried dignity. Reutemann had listened for the fifth stroke, but was glad that there were only four. Still time to get some sleep. He changed position. His wife cleared her throat without waking and instinctively snuggled up again to her husband. There was not the slightest sound from his son, asleep in the dining room. He never cried out or called them. The clever 3-year-old was the pride of his young parents. Adam Veniaminovich delighted in telling even the prisoners in the acoustics lab about his son's funny little ways and mischievous pranks. With the insensitivity common in happy people, he failed to realize that this could be painful to men deprived of fatherhood. He thought it a convenient topic of conversation. It brought him closer to the prisoners without in any way compromising him. The child prattled away fluently, but his pronunciation was shaky. He imitated his mother in the daytime and his father in the evening. His mother's brogue was from somewhere along the Volga. Adam's speech was thick, and there were regrettable faults in his pronunciation. Happiness, if it comes at all, often knows no bounds. This was the case with Adam. Love, marriage, and the birth of his son had come at the end of the war, together with his Stalin prize. Not that the war had been hard on him. Reutemann and some who were now his friends in the Morfino Institute had spent the war in peaceful Bashkiria, earning good money from the Commissariat of the Interior for their work on the first coded telephone system. That system looked primitive now, but it had brought them their Stalin prize. What enthusiasm, what passion they had put into it. Where had it all gone, that enthusiasm, that eagerness to learn, those flights of fancy? With the keen-sightedness of a man lying awake in the dark with nothing to divert his inward gaze, Reutemann suddenly realized what had been lacking in the last few years. Once he had done it all himself. Now he did not. He had slipped. When? How? From the role of creator to that of a supervisor of creators. Like a man scalded, he took his arms from around his wife and hitched his pillow higher. Yes, yes, yes! It was so easy, so irresistibly pleasant, when you were leaving for home on Saturday evening, enjoying in anticipation the 2 nights and a day of domestic comfort ahead and preoccupied with your plans for Sunday, to say, Valentin Martinich, don't forget now, you'll have to come up with some way of eliminating those non-linear distortions tomorrow. Lev Grigorievich, you will take a look at that article in Proceedings tomorrow, won't you? And make a brief list of the main points. When he returned to work refreshed on Monday morning, it was like a fairy tale. An abstract in Russian of the article in Proceedings would be on his desk, and Priantchikov would report on ways to eliminate non-linear distortions, if he hadn't done the job himself on Sunday. A very comfortable setup. Nor did the prisoners feel any resentment toward Reutemann. Indeed, they liked him, because he behaved toward them like a normal, decent human being, not a jailer. But the creative experience, the joyous lightning flash of inspiration, the mortification of unexpected setbacks, all that was a thing of the past. He freed himself from the bedspread and sat up in bed, clasping his knees and resting his chin on them. What had he been doing all these years? Intriguing. Fighting for the top place in the Institute. He and some of his friends had done everything they could to blacken and topple Yakonov, believing that his eminence and savoir-faire would put them in the shade, and that he would monopolize the Stalin Prize. His younger colleagues took advantage of the fact that Yakonov, with his tarnished past, would never be admitted to the party, and they made party meetings the arena for their attacks on him. They would call on him to make a report, then either ask him to withdraw or discuss it in his presence and adopt a resolution on which only party members were allowed to vote. According to these party resolutions, Yakonov was always in the wrong. Reutemann sometimes felt sorry for him, momentarily. But there was no other way. What a menacing turn things had now taken. The youngsters did not stop to think, when they were harrying Yakonov, that 4 out of the 5 of them were Jews. And now Yakonov never wearied of proclaiming from every possible platform that cosmopolitanism was the socialist fatherland's most vicious enemy. Yesterday had been a fateful day in the history of the Morfino Institute. After the minister's outburst, the prisoner Markushov had come up with the idea of combining the clipper and the vocoder. It probably made no sense, but it could be presented to the higher-ups as a radical improvement, and Yakonov had given instructions for the immediate transfer of the vocoder unit, Pranchikov with it, to No. 7. Reutemann was quick to object, in Selivanovsky's presence, but Yakonov patted him on the shoulder, as though he were a hot-headed friend who had to be humoured, and said,
"Adam Veniaminovitch, don't make the Deputy Minister think that you put your special interests above those of the Department of Special Technology."
That was what made the present situation so tragic. They punch you in the kisser, and you mustn't cry. They try to wring your neck in broad daylight, and you're expected to stand up and applaud. The clock struck 5. He had missed the half hour. He wasn't at all sleepy, and was beginning to feel uncomfortable in bed. Very carefully, 1 foot at a time, Adam slipped out of the bed and into his slippers. Noiselessly, avoiding a chair in his way, he went to the window and drew the silk curtains a little farther apart. What a lot of snow had fallen! Directly across the yard was the neglected far end of Neskuchny Sad. Its steep slopes were blanketed with snow and overgrown with stately white-decked pines. White fluff outlined the window frame. But the snowfall was almost over. The radiator under the window was rather hot to his touch. There was another reason why he had achieved so little as a scientist in recent years. He had been driven to distraction by meetings and paperwork. Politics class every Monday, technical class every Friday, party meetings twice monthly, party bureau meetings also twice monthly. He was summoned to the ministry in the evening 2 or 3 times a month. There was a special discussion on security once a month. A monthly research plan had to be drawn up, a monthly progress report written. Personal reports on every prisoner had to be sent in, for some reason, every 3 months. A whole day's work, that. And then some subordinate would come along every half hour to get his signature. Every wretched little condenser the size of a bonbon, every meter of wire, every radio valve, needed a signed authorization from the head of the laboratory, without which the stockrooms would release nothing. If only he could get rid of all that red tape, give up the battle for supremacy, pore undisturbed over his diagrams, handle a soldering iron, locate his miraculous curve through the greenish eye of an electronic oscillograph, he would sing boogie-woogie as lightheartedly as Prantchikov. Bliss it would be not to feel those epaulets pressing on his shoulders, forget the need to keep up appearances, to be himself, like a small boy, and make something, use his imagination. Like a schoolboy. A random memory of himself as a boy, an episode he had not remembered for many years, surfaced in his night thoughts with pitiless clarity. 12-year-old Adam, wearing his young pioneer's scarf, stood before an assembly of all the young pioneers in his school, a look of noble outrage on his face, denouncing an agent of the class as an enemy in a trembling voice and demanding his expulsion both from the young pioneers and from their Soviet school. The previous speakers, Mitka Stittelmann and Mishka Luxemburg, had also joined in exposing Oleg Rozhdestvensky as an anti-Semite, a churchgoer, a person of alien social origin, annihilating the trembling culprit with their hostile gaze. It was the end of the 20s, when for boys like Adam, life meant politics, wall newspapers, classroom democracy, earnest debate. In that southern town, about half of the group was Jewish. Some of the boys were the sons of lawyers, dentists, or small traders, but they were all fantastically insistent on their proletarian origin. Whereas this classmate of theirs tried not to talk about politics, moved his lips soundlessly when they sang the Internationale in chorus, and had joined the pioneers with obvious reluctance. The enthusiasts among the boys had long suspected him of being a counter-revolutionary. They had watched him closely, hoping to catch him. They had not been able to prove that he was of suspect origin. But Oleg gave himself away one day by saying that everyone has the right to say whatever he thinks. Stittelmann pounced on him. "Whatever he thinks? Nicola once called me an ugly yid. Is that allowed too?" That was the origin of the case against Oleg. Friends of his came forward to denounce him. Shurik Burikov and Shurik Varazhbit had seen the culprit going into the church with his mother and coming to school with a little cross around his neck. A round of meetings followed: pupils' committee, group committee, pioneer assemblies, playground huddles. and at all of them 12-year-old Robespierres came forward and, in the presence of the studying masses, stigmatized the abettor of anti-Semites and peddlers of religious opium, who had been too frightened to eat for a fortnight, and had told no one at home that he had been expelled from the Pioneers, and would shortly be expelled from school. Adam Reutemann had not been the ringleader. He had been drawn into it by others. But even now, his cheeks burned with shame and self-disgust when he thought of it. Insult and injury had come full circle. And there was no way out, just as there was no escape from his contest with Yakonov. Where should you start reforming the world? With other people? Or with yourself? By now his head was heavy enough and his heart empty enough for him to sleep. He went back and crawled quietly under the blanket. He simply must go to sleep before it struck six. In the morning he would step up the work on phonoscopy. That could be his trump card. If he succeeded with that, the project might expand into a separate research institute.